Welcome to the SDA Housing Podcast, brought to you by NDIS Property Australia. Before starting this episode, we need to provide a general disclaimer. Information contained in this podcast is general in nature only. It does not take into account the objectives, financial situation, or needs of any particular person. You need to consider your financial situation and needs before making any decisions based on the information in this podcast. And you should consider seeking independent and professional advice for your personal circumstances. All right, let's begin.
Hi there, my name is Matthew, and I'm your host today at NDIS Property Australia. This is the SDA Housing Podcast, a show that explains, highlights, guides, and brings awareness about all things SDA in this ever-changing NDIS world. This is the first of a series of episodes that we want to do on the SDA Housing Podcast of frequently asked questions. So in our time where we work with people across the board from developers, builders, participants, providers, and other stakeholders, we encounter a lot of different questions that crop up from time to time, and we do our best to answer them all, but sometimes it's easier if we can kind of make it into a more readable medium, I suppose, to put out there in terms of making sure that the message is received by people who are listening to our podcast. So this is a series of questions which I think are both asked frequently and the answers are good as a learning exercise, I suppose. So my first question that I was asked the other day was, I saw the following built properties that are for sale on your website. I have some questions. Do you build properties and then sell them, or are these properties being sold by owners through you? So this is a great question, and frequently in the market, I generally get asked a lot of times, you know, are there built properties in the SDA market? Why is there not built properties? What's the situation there? Should I be buying built properties? Should I be buying home and land packages? So the answer to that is the SDA scheme is relatively new in terms of the actual building industry. So most of the properties that you see out there, be them their houses, units, etc., because they are required to be built to a particular standard, and that standard did not exist, or it might have existed, but it wasn't formalized in paper until about 2016, where SDA really kicked into gear. Before that, because it didn't exist before that, those properties that were disability homes before that were kind of the old legacy built disability homes, and as such, they weren't necessarily built to the same standards, and in most cases, they weren't built to those standards. So in terms of built properties versus non-built properties, most of the properties you see out there on the market will be home and land packages, just because the scheme is fairly new. And that seems to be the case with us, where most of the properties are to-be-built stock. So once contracts are signed, that's when construction would typically start. Occasionally, you will find built stock. I tend to just make people aware in terms of the market that in a lot of cases, I always say, you know, look at the vested interest. Why is this property being sold? And in most cases for our business and for a lot of sellers of SDA existing stock out there, it's someone who's approached our business. They wanted to sell their property, be it for a myriad of reasons. Maybe they, you know, what they're going through a situation in life where they require that money. They can no longer, you know, you continue this build or owning this property. That would probably be the best case scenario. But worst case scenario might be, oh, this property is built in a bad position. It can't easily get participants. It doesn't have a provider attached to it. The property was built maybe on the lower end in terms of potential future proofing of the property, such that a provider doesn't want to touch it, or a participant wouldn't want to move into it. And as such, that's why they're selling. Because in the grand scheme of things, ultimately at the end of the day, if you look at a existing NDIS property that is doing well, say you're an investor, you've got an NDIS property, you've got two participants in it, it's a three-bedroom property, so 2+1 carer, and you're making, say, 150, 160K as a gross income. My question would be, why would you sell that property? So time and time again, I think a lot of people who do ask this question that's their general conclusion. So it's more of a confirmation where they ask us to confirm that. And yes, that's correct. So in a lot of situations, the reason why someone might sell an NDIS property is it's not achieving what they originally set out for or what they were sold to as being that income for that property. So they might have been sold maybe a lie or, you know, not a full truth where they were told, oh, I'm guaranteed an income or I'm definitely going to get participants, even though I'm building a substandard property in a substandard area, which wouldn't suit finding participants, making that process easier. For whatever reason, if they, you know, if they've got that property that does have the participants in it, there's no reason why you would sell it. Or if you did sell it, you'd sell it for a higher amount. You'd sell it for, say, 100K more than the market would have a similar property in the same area. So for the built stock, in summary, typically you'd be looking at a more expensive property. If it's got participants, if it's a good property. But if it's a poor purchase, there's a reason why it's a poor purchase, because it's in an area where it's hard to attract participants, or it doesn't have participants, or it doesn't have a provider. So I just tend to tell people just to be aware of that it's not always a good thing to have a built stock, because there's a reason why it's on the market. So I think that generally sums up the answer to that question. My next question that I get asked a lot is, are you in the business of converting existing houses into SDA properties? If so, what are the criteria for renovating a house to comply? How much would the cost be for different types of SDA funding? Sorry, different types of SDA housing. So this is a really, really good question. And a lot of people, we receive this call a lot, where it's someone who's heard about the NDIS, they might have very rudimentary knowledge and they think, oh, you know what, I'm going to convert my existing property, my investment property, into an NDIS property, which does sound good. However, the NDIS/the government has generally tried to move away from this model of constructing NDIS properties, because when you look at the old, and I just mentioned it earlier in that previous question, you look at the old legacy disability stock out there, that would be kind of in the same direction as renovating a property, where it's not the best it could be. It might be renovated to some extent, but it's still an old property, which might not be fit for purpose. On paper, if it fulfills the same criteria, it might be fit for purpose. But in the grand scheme of things, that property probably doesn't give the best lived experience to a participant living in the property. So as such, the NDIS has tried to move away from that model. And if you go online and you go to the NDIS website, there's a certain document called the Pricing Guidelines document, and it dictates how and in what context people can do renovations. So if your property is older than 2016, so it was built before 2016, there's a minimum amount that you need to spend on the renovations of the property. So that minimum amount outlined on page 35, it dictates that minimum amount that you need to spend on renovation for each individual type or category of NDIS property. So that minimum amount is about $400,000 for doing an IL. So doing HBS is like $550,000, at which point you might as well build a new property. So they're very incentivized people to go the renovation route. And it's a catch-22 situation, because if you've got an older property, you want to be doing the renovation on the older property. But if you've got a newer property that's newer than 2016, you don't have that, you know, $400,000, $500,000 renovation expenditure requirement, but you've got your new property. So you would feel disinclined to want to renovate a property that was built so recently. So they've very much made it difficult or unappealing from an investor standpoint to renovate an existing property. And in the 3.5 years, 4 years that we've been operating for, we have not encountered anyone who's actually done a renovation. So it is extraordinarily rare for someone to actually go down that route, just because the numbers don't stack up. We as a business don't do renovations, and we're not really aware of anyone who does do renovations. Builders from time to time may do it as kind of a custom project, but it wouldn't be their core business model. And I don't think there's many businesses out there who would have that as a core focus for their business. So I think that pretty much answers that question. The next question is, what's your take on the construction industry these days? So I see there's a host of reputable construction companies that have entered voluntary admission due to rising costs of construction materials and labour, straining further by supply chain issues. How are you managing this risk? How long does it take nowadays to build? So that's another really good question, because ultimately, at the end of the day, in a lot of situations, we tend to say that after tenancy risk, probably builder risk is the next significant risk. And those two are the main risks, I would say, in the SDA investment side of things. So the construction industry has recovered to some extent relative to where it was about 2 years ago coming out of COVID. So building times have gone down. Prices have stabilized to some extent in terms of on the building side, but interest rates and associated inflation have come up. Over last year, with the pricing update mid last year, they tried to address that increased interest rate and increased inflation by adjusting the income levels for participants in a property. They have tried to adjust that. In terms of construction, I think one of the biggest factors is build time. So the more time that it takes to do a build on average, the more potential there is for a blowout of cost, the more a change of inflation, a change of interest rates would dictate, you know, the builder not being able to follow through the project. And ultimately that would be, you know, that would be where the problems would arise. So generally across the board, that would be the main factor would be if the build takes a long time, there's a high chance that it could take a longer time, I would say. As well as that, another factor would be the number of properties that a building company is doing. If they're turning over properties consistently and in a timely fashion, that's all good signs, because it represents good cash flow in their company. They can afford to retain their laborers knowing that they have new projects to work on. If a company is not doing that, they're not going through a reasonable turnover of properties, it would mean that each individual project or each individual part of a build, they might need to acquire new labor. They might need to say, oh, we don't have anyone to do that at the moment because we couldn't put them on board because we're not doing that many that they would be kind of in the picture all the time. So we need to go acquire that labor to do that part of that build. And in situations like that, you would have potentially that taking longer or at potentially a higher cost if it wasn't budgeted for at the start of the build. So those are the kind of the two things you can look at just from an outsider's perspective without knowing too much of the background of a builder to ascertain, you know, the builder risk, I suppose. We as a company, we do background builder checks. So that's our way of managing the risk. To this date, we haven't had anyone go bankrupt on us, but obviously, you know, part of risk is that they're acknowledging the risk and being aware of it is one of the most important things, I suppose. So we are aware of it and we try to manage that risk by doing builder background checks. But as I mentioned, there's some other criteria which you can use to, I suppose, I wouldn't say judge, but could be factors to consider when deciding on a builder. So my next question, so this is question number 4. Is how do you see the SDA housing market in the next 5, 10, or 15 years? The government will most likely attempt to saturate the market. When do you think this will happen? How will future yields of SDA houses be affected by this? Okay, so this is a really good question. To keep a long answer short, I would say within the next 8 to 10 years, the SDA industry will be approaching a level where it's, you know, it's reaching maturity, I suppose. Currently, there are 22,000 people funded for SDA. At the moment, of that 22,000 that are funded, 7,000 are living in SDA. So your 15,000 out of that 22,000 are probably most likely in some form of disability home or legacy home or hospital or group home that isn't an SDA property, and they might not, you know, they might not be have all the choice and control that they should have as an SDA participant. So as such, those 15,000 participants will likely at some stage move over from their legacy or group homes to a purpose-built SDA home. So that currently, just going over those numbers again, there's 7,000 people living in SDA, and there's a further 15,000 that are living in some sort of group home or legacy property, leading to about 22,000 which are funded for SDA. The NDIS has indicated that around 30,000 people in total will be funded for SDA. So at the moment, that's about 7,000 more that are currently living in SDA will be funded. Obviously, these numbers will increase over time, but in the next, say, 8 to 10 years, you'd expect another 7,000 people to come through, added on top of the existing 30,000 that are funded. But the bigger component, as mentioned, is the 22,000 that are currently in group homes and will at some stage move over to SDA. So in terms of total NDIS properties built, at this stage, it's about, say, 3,500 to about 4,000 have been built. Obviously, by the end of the scheme, you would expect if there's 1.8 people living per dwelling, you'd expect a total amount built of around 15,000 or more. So we're still kind of in the early days. We've done about 3,500 out of that 15,000. So there's still a lot of construction, a lot of NDIS properties which still need to be built to accommodate the demand, and the demand that will be increasing as more participants move from a group home or legacy home setting to an SDA home that's built purpose-built. Last question, do you have a breakdown of the 50K plus per year net profit that is expected for NDIS properties? What do you think would be the expected profit? So this is a really good question. And I would say a lot of people who might be new to the SDA data and the way the SDA works, they might not be aware of how the income works, because it is different from the regular residential market. So the NDIS dictates the income levels for each participant category. Of all the different categories, I think there's about, I don't have the numbers in front of me actually, but there is about 70 to 80 individual categories of potential funding for participants, which is huge. To break that down and to simplify that, you've got your four main categories: IL, fully accessible, robust, and high physical support. So those four types of builds are essentially matched with those four types of participants. In your property that you might have as an investor, you might have a variety of different participants in your property. So a lot of people make the mistake of thinking, oh, if I build a HBS property, a high physical support property, I will have two HBS participants in that property plus one carer. But the reality of the situation is you might have participants from all categories except for robust in that HBS property. So you might have HBS participants, you might have FA participants, you might have IL participants, and you would likely have a combination of them. So you might have one HBS, one FA, one FA, one IL, two ILs, two FAs, a HBS and an IL, which is how, you know, we get to all the different kind of, I suppose, you couple that with all the different funding levels for each participant, and that's where it gets a bit complex and leads up to that number that I mentioned before in terms of like the 80 different combinations of funding. So there's several factors involved in the income of the property. So one that I just mentioned is the type of participant living in your property. To break that down further, there's how much a participant is funded for. So typically in a house, you'd have participants funded for 2-to-1 funding, or say 3-to-1 funding. So 3-to-1 funding would mean that participant living in that property has funding as if they were sharing a house with two other people, even though they might be in that property as the only person or with only one other person. If they had funding for 1-to-2, they would live in that property as if they would be funded to live with one other person. Regardless of their actual living situation, the funding level remains, and they would be funded to that level. So you might have in your house, you might have someone who has 1-to-3 funding with someone who has 1-to-2 funding, even though they're two people living in the house. At the same time, you might have someone who has 1-to-2 funding and they're the only person living in the house, or you might have someone who has 1-to-3 funding and then the only person living in the house. Regardless of the situation, generally the number of participants in a property, the more that increases, the less you are paid per participant living in the property. Obviously, that depends on the individual funding levels, because you could have 1-to-3 or 1-to-2 and no one else is living in the property. But if it were a four-bedroom property, if you did have three participants in that property that were all 1 to 2, 1 to 2, 1 to 2, you would have, they would become 1 to 3. So there's always it's called the rule of the lesser of rule that dictates that income. So to kind of summarize that, you would have, you've got your participants living in your property that dictate your income. You've got their individual funding levels within that category, and you've got how many participants are in the property. The next factor, and I suppose I'm using the right word here, would be the location factor. So the NDIS has given different areas of Australia different location factors, which is their way of kind of incentivizing people to build in certain areas that they feel lack SDA properties or represent a significant risk for an investor, where they need to adjust, I suppose, the incentive towards building that location. So you might see, for instance, in Darwin, the location factor is very high, where you have your participants will generate a factor more income for the same participant living in the same property. In areas like, say, Brisbane or Melbourne, you might have close to a 1.00 factor where the income is at the standard level. But in, say, Darwin, you might have 1.6, where it's 60% more or whatnot than you'd expect for just a normal property in a normal area, whatever that normal means, but just a general average location factor, I suppose. So that's another factor. And yeah, so those are the main factors dictating the income of the property. So the general breakdown of 50K per year, that would be in the case of having a IL participant in a property that's generating, say, 60 to 70,000, and they've got, say, 1 to 2 funding. So they're generating, yes, say 70,000 with 1 to 2 funding. So if you did have two IL participants with 1 to 2 funding, both of them in your property, you would have a total income of about 140,000 as a gross income. If you had one participant, that's 70,000. You would expect your expenses to be around, say, 20,000. It's hard for me to say, kind of just because it does get into the area of, you know, your own situation, and you know, it would depend on your own participants, your own pricing structure, your own expenditure, your own costs. But that's how that number comes about, that 50K. Yeah, so that's five questions that I had today that kind of I thought were really, really useful and have answers which give a lot of value in terms of understanding the way NDIS works better. So this will likely be a series going forward of frequently asked questions, and I'll hopefully come across more questions moving forward that both are asked regularly, are good questions to ask, and the answers give a lot of value. So as usual, if you do have any questions moving forward that you do feel we could help answer, feel free to give us a call or send them through. Excellent. Thanks so much, guys. We'll see you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please make sure you are subscribed and following us so you can keep in the loop with all of our upcoming episodes. We would really appreciate it if you could leave us a 5-star rating, a written review, and just share this podcast with those that could benefit. Until next time, catch you on the next episode.